Okay, you ready? Two words. First word, one syllable, rhymes with grade. Second word, one syllable, rhymes with more. Grade. More. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 19th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I am not going to use the TW phrase here, I think. Trade war. But I am going to point out, as we get going, the trade and tariff threats flying back and forth between Washington and Beijing have had a certain symmetry to them. We tax $34 billion worth of Chinese imports. They follow suit. We add $16 billion in other Chinese stuff. Same, same. But last night, the Trump administration said it's exploring another round, tariffs on a whopping $200 billion worth of Chinese goods, at which point Beijing said, fine, we are going to hit back in, quote, quantitative and qualitative ways. What, Kai, I hear you asking, might that mean? Suffice it to say here that China's got a long and creative history of making life miserable for American companies. Over there, Scott Tong was once our bureau chief in Shanghai. Nowadays, he works out of our Washington bureau, and he has got the story.
China can't impose tariffs on $200 billion worth of U.S. goods because it doesn't even buy that much. But it has plenty of other walls or doors to put up against U.S. companies. China investor Chip Chaikin is with Blue Point Capital Partners.
People of a certain age might remember the TV show Get Smart when, you know, he's trying to run through an alley and doors keep slamming in front of him.
Would you believe sometimes American firms can't get their money out of China?
Just the banks sometimes are told to facilitate it, and sometimes they're told not to facilitate it.
Here's another non-tariff wall. American firms that export to China, say engines or computer chips or tires, encounter limits on how much they can send there. Quotas. Lynn Fisher Fox, a former U.S. trade negotiator, is with the law firm Arnold & Porter.
A quantitative restriction may drive Chinese manufacturers or Chinese consumers of U.S. products to search for a different source of supply outside the United States.
And then there are conveniently timed inspections when multinational companies miss Chinese standards by that much. Last year, during a Chinese military spat with South Korea, Korean-branded supermarkets suddenly got shut down in China for violating fire code. Jim Rice is a former American Chamber of Commerce governor in Shanghai.
It makes better domestic press if you're busting a foreign company. We saw it a while back when Häagen-Dazs got in trouble for some hygiene standards.
He says U.S. executives in China are likely nervous today because life could get a whole lot harder. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
$200 billion is a whole lot of tax on a whole lot of Chinese goods. But there is another side to the Sino-American trading relationship that we haven't really been talking about as much. The roughly $56 billion worth of services the U.S. sells to China every year. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explores that smaller but growing side of U.S.-China trade.
Trade isn't just goods packed into shipping containers, stacked on boats, and sent across the ocean. Students coming to the U.S. to study, that actually counts as an export. Tourists visiting the U.S., same. Scott Kennedy is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
If you look at what the U.S. exports to China in the way of services, travel, tourism, and education is number one.
Other services exports include licensing fees or royalties for American intellectual property and transportation services like FedEx deliveries. We had about a $40 billion trade surplus in services with China last year.
$40 billion is really not very much, but it's symbolically important.
Derek Scissors is with the American Enterprise Institute.
There are people who think if we could make a good deal with China, we could have a lot more services exports to China. I don't agree with that. I don't think the Chinese would ever allow it.
But Erin Ennis with the U.S.-China Business Council is slightly more optimistic. She says China's the fastest-growing services market for the U.S.
Realistically, they've been talking about liberalization and financial services in particular for the last 2 years, and the groundwork has been done. What that looks like, you know, the devil is frequently in the details.
She says how much China opens its services market and how fast is unclear. Also unclear whether the present trade tensions will derail that progress. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
As I said, the latest ratcheting up of the trade war happened last night. So when Wall Street woke up this morning, it was not happy, stayed a little cranky all day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. There is no sign at all the White House is backing down or considering changing its new immigration policies. At a speech today at the National Federation of Independent Businesses, President Trump kept up his hardline defense of his new policy. But whether things change or not, the current state of play is the daily reality for a lot of people living and working along the border. It's just amplified quite a bit. Marketplace's Andy Euler has been to Brownsville, Texas, the past couple of days, right on the border. Hey, Andy.
Hey, Kai.
First of all, what are you seeing down there just as you walk around?
So I got into town a couple of days ago, like you said, and immediately went to the detention center that everybody's sort of talking mm-hmm. about, the converted Walmart that was turned into a house for 1,500 immigrant detainee children. But when you walk around Brownsville, it's interesting because the people here, they're a little bit intimidated by how many people are coming into their town from out of town to sort of look at what's going on, because they sort of tell you that they're used to this and that this is sort of a part of the life here at the border. I mean, you can literally walk 10 minutes from downtown Brownsville and be in Mexico. I think the escalation of the policies is one thing, but for them, this is everyday life.
Yeah. When you say used to this, you mean having a detention facility in the middle of town.
Interestingly enough, yeah. I mean, this company, Southwest Key, was actually started here in Brownsville. It was sort of a nonprofit. It used to house about 50 kids when they didn't have anywhere to go. And they have sort of turned into a nonprofit behemoth that deals with more than $1 billion annually.
Wow.
They have 27, they run 27 immigrant children shelters in Texas, Arizona, California. But they also do youth justice and wellness programs. And I did get an email from the folks at Southwest Key just a minute ago. And they said they wanted to be clear, they're not running a detention center. That's the federal government. What they're providing is health care for the kids who were separated from their parents or who came to the border alone. So they're sort of making that distinction between, look, the federal government is paying us to do this and we're just providing a service.
Fair enough and worth a note. The folks who work at the Southwest Key facilities there, are they locals, right? I mean, they're just folks from Brownsville who have a job, right?
That's exactly right. And I actually spoke with Ben Neese, who is a city commissioner, and he had such an interesting sort of take on these detention centers, because he talked about sort of the necessity of them. He understands that they're providing jobs for the people here in Brownsville and wouldn't have it any other way.
If we were to lose 1,200 workers, I don't know what the exact impact would be, but it would be bad. Mm. So Brownsville doesn't really want to do anything to flex a muscle against the government. You know, you can only work within your authority.
He also told me that it's interesting for people in Brownsville who are very, very sort of family oriented to be hearing about things that are happening at these local detention centers from national media. They say that it's sort of off-putting for them, because they know that it is. They have friends that have jobs there.
Marketplace's Andy Euler down in Brownsville, Texas, the private industry side of that immigration story. Andy, thanks.
You got it, Kai. Thank you.
Today is a milestone of sorts in the American innovation economy. Back in 1836, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office issued patent number 1 under the current numbering system. It took 155 years to 1991 to get up to patent number 5 million, and then just another 27 years to get to today. Patent number 10 million was issued today for something called coherent LIDAR using intrapixel quadrature detections. The technology is owned by Raytheon. It was invented by Joseph Marin. He is a principal engineering fellow at the company's Space and Airborne Systems Division. So we called him up. Dr. Marin, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you.
So first of all, what is a coherent LIDAR using intrapixel quadrature detection thing anyway?
Okay, so it's a system. It's similar to a digital camera, except it measures speed and distance. And applications include driverless cars or video games and things like that.
So this is probably not patent approved language, but this is a handy dandy thing to have in this day and age with autonomous cars and video games.
It is. It's very timely for robotics and measurement and things. Yeah, you know, all those things.
This is not your first patent, but still, it's got to be 10 million. It's got to be special, right?
It is very special. It's exciting. I think the dream of every inventor is to have such a remarkable number associated with their patent.
So you went to the White House today. The president signed the certificate thing. Do you get that and you get to hang it on the wall, or does that go to Raytheon, or does it hang somewhere else?
I think Raytheon gets the original. I hope to get a copy.
Wow. It seems like you ought to get the original, actually.
I agree.
If you're the guy.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, though. It does seem, just looking at the numbers, as I said in the introduction, the pace at which we are inventing things in this economy is proceeding rapidly. It's accelerating really quickly.
It is, yes. I think my first patent in the year 1990 was number a little bit over 5 million.
Wow.
And since then, we're up to 10 million.
When push comes to shove, do you get anything for this except maybe a little extra bump in your paycheck from Raytheon?
You know, I'm hopeful that I get that extra little bump.
But let's say Tesla buys this thing, right? And they decide to use it in their new autonomous car or, you know, Waymo or whoever. Raytheon gets the proceeds, right?
Correct. Yeah, that's part of my employment agreement.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, Dr. Marin, thanks very much for your time, sir. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up.
I mean, they also just are incredibly practical when it comes to online shipping.
Small plants becoming big business. But first, let's do the numbers. Tariff threats and counter threats from Washington and Beijing loomed over Wall Street today. As I said, Dow Industrials went south 1.1%, 287 points, closed at 24,700. S&P 500 down 0.4%, about 11 points, 2762. The NASDAQ down nearly 0.3%, 21 points, 77.25. One of the sectors with a lot of exposure to China and so feeling the pain, computer and telecommunications hardware. Qualcomm lopped off 0.8% today. Intel down about 0.5%. Lumentum tumbled nearly 3% today. And then there's Apple tied up with China in all kinds of ways. The company added Cupertino down 1.6% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.89%. You're listening to Marketplace. We heard from Catherine in Bellingham, Washington the other day, who says she finds great value in how Marketplace explains things like tax reform and how changing fiscal policy affects our lives. If you agree with Catherine, please join her by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to Catherine and all the Marketplace investors who make our work possible.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity. A how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As we mark 10 years since the financial crisis, this observation. We felt it most particularly here, but it was a global crisis, and what happened here played out overseas a lot. Our project, Divided Decade, that we've been doing this year, is all about how life has changed since and because of the financial crisis and the Great Recession. One of the things that happened was that Americans and Europeans bought less stuff from China. Dozens of factories in the southern part of that country closed. Something like 20 million migrant workers found themselves out of a job. But in at least one farming community, an unexpected industry flourished. Marketplace's Jennifer Pak went to Jiangsu province in eastern China.
On a dusty road in Guanyin County, some 300 miles north of Shanghai, a slim middle-aged man stands in front of an open truck. He plays an announcement through a speaker. Apples for sale, 18 cents a pound, it says. That's cheap even for China. Guanyin County is among the poorest areas in this region. Things are changing, though, thanks in part to this soft-spoken man. Businessman Lei Chongrei is 27. A decade ago, when he was still in high school, he ran an online shop selling slippers, cosmetics, and lingerie. When the financial crisis hit in 2008, China's government called on its citizens to spend more. Lei Chongrei noticed he was receiving dozens of orders a day from cities for cheap lingerie.
But our suppliers couldn't keep up. We had no choice but to produce lingerie ourselves.
He was among the first wave of people in Guanyin County to do this. He bought cutting machines like this one that he still uses in his workshop and some fabric. It cost him $50,000. He learned how to sew and drew simple designs so that his staff of seven, mostly relatives, could learn to make the garments. Next, he recruited sellers. His friends, neighbors, even his middle school teacher's wife joined in.
A lot of people didn't even know how to use the internet. I had to help them set up online shops so they could sell my products.
Within a year, Lei Chongrei made his first million yuan, just over $150,000. He quit college to focus on his business. Today, he's one of 500 lingerie manufacturers in Guanyin County. 3 out of 5 intimate apparel and revealing costumes sold online in China are made here. Lei Chongrei shows me his warehouse. It's filled with sheer dresses, fishnet stockings, and Playboy Bunny outfits. He says local competitors copied his design so much that he switched his focus from domestic consumers to exporting in 2014 as Western economies recovered and foreign sales picked up. Today, he makes between $7 and $9 million in sales a year. His business relies on a network of housewives from the village to sew. Villagers here have seen disposable income almost triple since 2008. The transformation has been dramatic. Pricey high-rise apartments have replaced wheat fields. But what do local women think of the flimsy lace they're sewing? Here's Li Jiaojiao and Chen Xinwei.
I still don't like the look of them.
Some of the designs are pretty, but they don't cover much. I can't wear them.
In this promotional video made by the county government, Guanyin officials don't seem to share the same reservations. The county plans to invest more than $400 million to build lingerie brands and compete with the likes of Victoria's Secret. This type of government support for China's industries is part of the reason trade relations with the U.S. have been tense. Lei Chongrei now ships almost half of his products to America, but he doesn't seem worried about the current U.S.-China standoff.
If the U.S. doesn't want our products, we can sell more to Africa.
Business is so good that Lei Chongrei says he's already building an even bigger factory across the road. In Guanyin County, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
The health insurance policy phrase of the day this Tuesday is association health plans. The idea is to help people, small employers and individuals most specifically, to be able to buy health insurance. Less expensive coverage, generally speaking, that could be attractive to people who've gone without coverage as premiums have been going up. But the no such thing as a free lunch clause on this thing means that these new plans that the Labor Department approved today won't provide nearly as much coverage as the ones sold on the Affordable Care Act exchanges. From the health desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that story.
The Trump administration believes these association plans will make coverage cheaper in two ways. First, they'll try to limit who signs up.
To, cherry pick and attract the people who are least likely to use the coverage.
Karen Politz is with the Kaiser Family Foundation. The way the new rule was written, these plans have to accept you if you have a pre-existing condition and can't charge you more for having one. But they can charge more based on your industry, your particular job, gender, and age, says Politz.
So they could set their premiums in such a way to make it very difficult for someone like me, who's about to have her 60th birthday, but to make it very attractive for my kids who are in their 20s to come in.
The other way to make health insurance cheaper? Cover less stuff. Under Obamacare, all plans must cover mental health, prescription drugs, and maternity care. The new plans don't have to. Al Bingham, an actuary with Wakely Consulting, says that could drive premiums down.
Prescription drugs can be, you know, as much as 30% of premium in small group types of plans. You have a plan that doesn't cover drugs, then you're going to have a less expensive premium.
New association plans could be here as soon as September, and they could be an attractive alternative for some employers or self-insured people who find Obamacare plans too costly. But many people could find these sorts of plans lacking. And with the ACA mandate penalty going away, some consumers may decide to just go without any coverage. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
We don't do a whole lot of vegetation on this program. Yes, I said vegetation, plant life, but we are nothing if not adaptable, about which the same can be said of the subject of this next item. Botanical specimens that are becoming ever more popular, succulents, can be found in farmers markets, certainly, but also restaurants and retailers, also social media. Alyssa Bereznek from The Ringer wrote a piece recently headlined, How Succulents Took Over Instagram and Then the World. Alyssa, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Not to take issue right off the bat, but the subhead on this thing says 30 years ago, the mostly unkillable plants. And I will tell you that I now have a dead succulent on my desk. It's been dead for about 2 years.
And well, it's still there. Whose fault is that?
Yeah, well, yeah. But the point is, they are not the be all and end all, right? You got to treat them as plants.
Yeah, they're not these invincible beings. Right. I will say they are the preppers of the plant universe, though. They do a lot to survive on their own.
Well, which makes sense, and which we'll get to in a minute. Let me ask you this, though. They have become now, seemingly out of nowhere, kind of a thing.
They are kind of a thing.
How come?
I would say it's a combination of things. First, there was a drought, and that really contributed to their use in landscaping.
Yeah, you're talking and about the one out here in California, right?
Yes, the one out there in California. Yeah. But also, they look really nice on social media.
Wow.
I mean, they also just are incredibly practical when it comes to online shipping. That's how millennials shop now. So a millennial is not going to go to a plant store. That involves talking to people. This is like just a really automatic thing. You type in succulent in your search bar in Amazon. You don't have to pay any shipping, and it arrives on your doorstep, and all of a sudden you have a nice decoration in your home.
You mentioned millennials. I chuckled, but the rise in, I think what you call in this piece, millennial gardeners is kind of stunning.
Yeah, I mean, they're just blowing up. Partly it's a cheap way to take care of a living thing. If you kill a plant, you can start over. It's also low maintenance. I mean, succulents, like I said, do a lot to survive on their own. And, you know, we're all very busy. We work constantly on our phones and our laptops. So those are a lot of the reasons that I think younger people are getting into gardening.
Right. There are also breeding programs and I guess, international smuggling operations with succulents, right?
Yes, they are a hot commodity. Altman Plants, which is the largest succulent provider in the United States, they have two breeders, and their jobs are basically just to develop very people-friendly and colorful plants.
Hmm.
And I'm talking like iterations like the Christmas Sleigh Aloe, which is this beautiful sort of green and red plant with pretty bumps on it. And it's just like looks great in a square in your feed. It's perfect for that.
In your Instagram
then,
feed, in a square picture.
In your Instagram feed, yes. The only feed. And as for smugglers, yeah, there was an operation that was bringing them back to Asia. They were just taking them out of their natural habitats in Northern California. that was a wild thing that happened recently, and they were making a pretty good amount of money per plant.
Amazing. All right, so I have confessed my succulent-killing tendencies. You have succulents in your apartment? I mean, are you doing it right?
I do indeed. I'm a proud plant mom.
How many? Give me a clue.
I think it's about, I'm at 10 now, so I'm bringing them into the office more often because they, you know, they sprout little pups too.
I didn't know that, but okay. Alyssa Bereznak, writing at The Ringer on succulents. Alyssa, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, and I know this phrase is overused, but this really is the end of an era. S&P Dow Jones Indices, the company that owns and controls and decides who's in and who's out of a whole bunch of stock indices, including the Dow Jones Industrial Average, announced today that GE is out of the Dow to be replaced by Walgreens Boots Alliance. The change is effective before the open a week from today, June the 26th. GE is perhaps the original American industrial conglomerate. It was for a long time, a very long time, the most valuable company in this economy. And it was one of the original 12 companies in the Dow. All right, we got to go. Pretty decent losing streak now for the Dow, by the by. Down 0.1% today, 287 points. NASDAQ off nearly 0.3%, 21 points. S&P 500 off 0.4%, that's 11 points. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.